Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to now commence. Thank you for your patience. Or all of you came here early to make sure you at least got your bum onto a seat. My name is Jeremy Borain. I'm the Publishing Director at Jonathan Ball Publishers. A warm welcome to you all and to our two panelists, Mark Francisco and Andy Feinstein, who will be in conversation today. I'm only going to say a few things at the beginning of this to get the ball rolling, and then I'm really pretty much going to hand over to them. I think they're the ones who have got a lot of very interesting things to say. I'm going to get the ball rolling and then sort of give them maybe half an hour to sort of put various questions and scenarios to each other, and then I think we'll open it up to questions from the floor, where we'll take questions in sort of batches or groups, and then run that on to 6 o'clock. But by way of introduction, I just want to know, at the end of last year, around October, November, we... thank you, Sandra. Two very important books were published. The one, Thabo Mbeki, The Dream Deferred by Martha Fisser, and the other one, After the Party by Andrew Feinstein. Both have done exceptionally well sales-wise, but I think much more importantly than that, they have certainly contributed greatly to the political discussion that's taking place in South Africa today. I'm going to start off by asking both of them a question, and then they're going to kind of take it from there. It's going to be the Mark and Andrew Act. Mark, I'll start with you, but let me ask both questions, first to Mark and then to Andrew, and then I'll hand over to you. You spent 9 years writing your book, and you finished writing perhaps just under a year ago. So it's been a year really since you've written. In the book, obviously, you've written a lot more since then. What happened? Did you anticipate where we would be here today, a year ago? What happened at Polokwane? What happened at Thabo Mbeki? Could you have anticipated that things would have changed so fundamentally in 12 months? And Andrew, you also finished writing about a year ago, and again, there's been a watershed in many of the areas that you touch on.
Yeah.
The arms deal that just won't go away. In particular, Jacob Zuma was mentioned on trial in August, and I suppose my question to you is more about him, and that is, will he ever go on trial, and what does his future hold?
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeremy. I should respond to your question by saying that, as you well know, if I had my druthers, I would never have published the book last year. The person who made me publish the book last year, just before Polokwane, was him. The historian in me, the cautious conservative in me, wanted to wait until the story was over, so that I could put a full stop at the end of it. The publisher, and I've realized retrospectively, I'm extremely fortunate to have a publisher who's not conservative and cautious, said nothing doing. Now is when interested is at an all-time high, now is when the book has to come out. We had an argument, he won, the book came out, and I'm eternally grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Now I'm able to buy my beach house with the proceeds. not. But the point is that obviously it was very difficult to publish a serious literary biography about Thabo Mbeki at a time when his destiny was unfulfilled, and when none of us, not me, not any of you, not Thabo Mbeki himself, knew how the story was going to end. And I had to work very carefully to craft the book in such a way that it would be relevant at the time it was published and remain relevant now. And one of the, I would be lying if I said, I could have predicted that Alecky was going to stand at Polokwane, lose, and then all the wheels were going to come off his legacy and his presidency. No, I didn't predict that. But I certainly knew that the dream would remain deferred, one way or the other, which is why I chose to call my book The Dream Deferred. I think the dream remains deferred for him, of being sort of accepted and loved as a leader who can save his people. Certainly the dream remains deferred for all of us as South Africans wanting a solution. And I think the way, what I tried to do with the title of The Dream Deferred was to say, if you think of dreams that can be won, if you think of a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, you're always going to be disappointed. So anybody who thought that it's after Polokwane, either because of Zuma or because of Mbeki, all our problems were going to be solved and we were going to sort of become the world's greatest fairy tale again, was is going to have been deeply disappointed. And the point I try and make in my work and with my book is to say, if you imagine this sort of resolution as a South African story, as a dream that's going to be realized, you're always going to be disappointed. And what we are enduring at the moment, and it is something of an endurance test, I think you'll all agree, is process. It's what happens in a difficult, deeply divided, developing society where there are no easy solutions and where there's never a kind of victory, a conclusion, arrival. There's just always a road along which we have to travel. And the road happens to be particularly bumpy at the moment. And I think really the road was always going to be bumpy, whether Mbeki would have stood, won or lost the qualifying, the road was going to be bumpy. Perhaps it's a little bit bumpier than I and most of us anticipated, but it's wrong to think the road is ever going to be smooth given the society we live in.
Thanks, Mark. I didn't have much say in when the book was published, in the sense that Jeremy wanted it from me constantly, and it took me about 6 months after his demand to actually get it to him.
He's so, very demanding.
So when an SABC interviewer said to me, my first interview in fact, after the book came out, he held up a copy of the book and slapped it down on his desk and said, you only published this now as part of Tokyo Sekwale's campaign at Polokwane. I felt like blaming Jeremy, but he wasn't there at the time, so I couldn't. But I do just want to endorse what Mark said about how incredibly important it was, I think, for both of us to have such a courageous and supportive publisher, for which we're both very grateful. In terms of what has happened subsequently to the book coming out, we have found out along the way a little bit more about the arms deal, as is always the case. The way that these things happen is that information comes out in little drips and goes on for years and years and years. In the case of one of the most controversial deals that we know a lot about, the Bhopal deal that was done with India, it took 14 years before the truth eventually came out. And when it did, it brought down Rajiv Gandhi's first government, the first time that the Congress movement lost power since independence in India. In terms of the specific question about Jacob Zuma, I'm meant to be a state witness in the Zuma trial. And my wife, because we now live in London, has constantly been trying to plan holidays in South Africa around when I have to appear. And I said to her, well, it is possible that the holiday might only be in 10 years' time. Because I do think that what is happening at the moment is that the strategy of Jacob Zuma's defense team seems to be to raise technicalities for as long as possible, I would assume, to ensure that the trial does not start before the likely election in April of next year, and then the situation can be dealt with somewhat differently. At present, our constitution and legislation does not provide a sitting president with any immunity from prosecution. But of course, it is not particularly difficult to introduce legislation to create such immunity. And it does exist in other countries, the most obvious being France, where Jacques Chirac remains in office way past his sell-by date to to avoid being prosecuted for various misdemeanors in relation to party funding, and the day after he left office, sure enough, the charges were laid. Now, I suppose one has to take the question a step forward and say, does Jacob Zuma have a legitimate claim to answer? And while I believe, and I suggest in the book, that prosecutions and actions emanating from the arms deal have been extremely selective, and I would suggest to achieve political ends, the fact that not everybody or not many of those who should be prosecuted in relation to the arms deal have not been prosecuted and might not be prosecuted does not in any way mitigate or lessen the guilt of those who have either faced trial, like Shabir Sheikh and Tony Yengeni, or Jacob Zuma, who is confronted with these corruption and fraud charges. And in terms of considering whether he has a case to answer, I would suggest that it is extremely important to look at the Sheikh trial, first of all at the charge sheet, where the intention was to charge the two of them together. Second of all, at the judgment, in terms of which Shabir Sheikh was found guilty, ostensibly of soliciting money for Jacob Zuma, in return for which Jacob Zuma undertook various actions in what the judge described as a mutually beneficial symbiotic relationship. Remember also that Shabir Sheikh has failed on three attempts to have his conviction overturned, including in the Constitutional Court. That since the Sheikh trial, there has been additional evidence involving a further 3.5 million rand. And that the Constitutional Court, in ruling on the forfeiture of Shabir Sheikh's assets, said in a judgment on the 30th of May that Sheikh's legal team, and I quote, correctly accepted that Mr. Sheikh, with the intention to corrupt, bribed Mr. Zuma for the purpose of promoting Mr. Sheikh's business interests. And in attending the meeting with Thompson CSS, a winning bidder in the arms deal in London in July 1998, Mr. Zuma did, as a matter of fact, promote Mr. Sheikh's interests. So to my mind, and with the knowledge that I have about the arms deal and the machinations behind it, I feel very strongly that Jacob Zuma does have a case to answer. And I do believe that it would be far better for South Africa's democracy, for the ANC, and for Jacob Zuma himself, if that trial took place sooner rather than later, so that he had his day in court, and that if he is found not guilty, he can get on with his life and his political career. And if he is found guilty, that he suffer the consequences and the political process move on as a consequence of it.
It seems to me, Andrew, that there's a sort of three-pronged approach, and I wonder if you can comment on this. The first is definitely to delay the trial as long as possible. And I think that it's becoming clearer to those of us watching this that there is no way the trial will have started before elections next year, which means that I think I'm correct in assuming, right, that Jacob Zuma will be our next president. Because he certainly will not have been found guilty by next March or April. So the one strategy is to delay things as much as possible. The other is to dig up as much dirt as possible on everybody who might have been involved in the arms deal towards the end of some kind of, I think, amnesty process. And I'm interested to hear your opinion of the possibilities of an amnesty around the arms deal, and if there was such an amnesty, how it should work, and what the consequences would be. I have my own thoughts about it, but would like to hear yours first.
I think that's quite right. I think the other part of the strategy is to try and dig up as much dirt as possible. We had this extraordinary occasion where immediately post-Polokwane, the new leadership of the ANC stated that they would now hold an internal inquiry into the arms deal because they didn't know what had happened in the arms deal. Now, this was in the face of a government that had, for over 5 years previously, been saying there was a full and thorough investigation and basically everybody was exonerated except these two or three people, and they're facing the consequences now. Now, my contention is, as I say in the book, there was nothing of the sort. There was a highly selective, muted investigation that in fact didn't investigate the main corruption allegations that had been raised by the Auditor General. I have no problem with the fact that there is an attempt to dig up dirt on others. I think that this is all part of the process that will eventually lead to the truth coming out. Obviously, it's being done to achieve certain political ends. Now, in terms of the issue of the amnesty, I feel very strongly that ideally what the country requires, because I do feel that the country is in need of almost a moral regeneration, a moral revival. And an incredibly good starting point of that would be a comprehensive and unfettered judicial and expert inquiry into the arms deal and exactly what happened. And that if prosecutions follow from that, so be it. Now the reality is that politically the chances of that happening are virtually zero. So then the option of the amnesty comes up. Now, I feel that what we as South African citizens would require from an amnesty is three crucial things. The first is that anybody seeking amnesty has to disclose fully their involvement in the arms deal. And that would require that the amnesty process had a very effective investigative dimension to it. The second would be that any ill-gotten gains would have to be returned to the fiscus. And the third would need to be that anybody who admitted to benefiting inappropriately from the arms deal would have to leave public office if they were in public office now and would not be able to stand for public office in the future, which would obviously undermine the strategy as you've outlined. But those would be the only conditions, as far as I'm concerned, that would make an amnesty acceptable.
It's impossible that such conditions would be met, I think. There's some model for amnesty in this country, the one of course being through the Reconciliation Commission, which is where you have to fess up. You don't need to say you're sorry, but you need to say what you did. And you say it publicly, and the country goes through a whole drama. We experience, we deal with memory and with history as the gross violations of human rights are accounted. The second way is the tax man's approach, the Pravin Gordhan way, if you like. I don't need to know that you've got an offshore account, but Pravin Gordhan needs to know. Somebody knows. There's accountability somewhere. And that happens because it brings people into the net and therefore enables the taxman to carry on taxes. Now, I personally can't see either of those approaches happening if there was amnesty. The only way, partly because we've got to remember that implicated in the arms deal are not just politicians seeking public office, but chief executives of corporations that are listed on the stock exchange and whose primary accountability is to their shareholders. I can't see that happening. So it seems like if there was going to be amnesty, the only way it would be a kind of wipe the slate clean way, which would make a mockery of the kind of accountability that was spoken about at Polokwane at the end of last year. Which I guess brings me to my next question to you. The period that you write about in the ANC, in after the party, is a period where, despite the ANC's alleged history and tradition of contestation and open debate, there were very, very few people who were willing to put their heads about the trenches of the country. You were one, Craig Governor was another, pretty much stuck there. And I suppose I've got two questions for you. The first is, why was that? Why were people so quiet? The second question is, right now we're seeing a kind of new energy in the legislature. Suddenly we're seeing parliamentarians who've been sleeping for the last 10 years standing up and questioning the executive all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to know what you think, having been a parliamentarian yourself, whether you think this is opportunistic, whether this is a way for Luthuli House to get at the union building constitutionally through the Houses of Parliament, or whether perhaps a genie has been unbottled at Polokwane, whether there is a new culture of accountability now, and even if a new leadership comes in and tries to bottle that genie again, there perhaps are some people sitting in Parliament who found their voices, who are not going to be shut up again.
interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Thank you. I'm going to answer your question, and in so doing, put one to you, if I may. First of all, why so quiet? And I think it's extremely important to note that while I did speak out and took a stand on the arms deal, along with other people, not in the ANC, but in other parties, in civil society, and it's also, it is very important to bear in mind when talking about the arms deal, that the first leaks of information that were made to Patricia de Ville actually came from two ANC members of parliament on Parliament's Defence Committee. And those people, I mean, that took extraordinary courage. Far greater courage than it took for me. I knew that I could get a good job outside of politics. These people remain in the legislature. And there are some people in the ANC who know that they were the original sources of information. And the second point to make is also that I didn't speak up on AIDS. And I suppose I could try retrospectively and unsuccessfully to justify it along the lines of I was somewhat engaged in other things. But even though I was engaged in the public council doing the arms stuff, I don't think that means I couldn't have been engaged on the AIDS issue. And I think what happens is we all experience this profound change of culture in a very immediate way. When we first went into Parliament, or in my case, the legislature and then Parliament, everything was debated and contested almost to an extreme. And from 1998, when Thabo took over as president of the ANC, that started to change. It started to change initially in subtle ways. There was less debate in caucus meetings. There was less opportunity to put a different view. There was a greater intolerance towards different views coming not necessarily from the person of the president himself, but from those who had been put in positions of authority as chairpersons of caucuses, as heads of important committees, those sorts of things, who closed down the debate. And I think that one of the fairly important moments came around the early parts of the crisis in Zimbabwe, where one or two senior figures did speak out, interestingly, in Parliament, and were told quite explicitly by the presidency that they would need to change their tune. And in an instance, somebody did in fact change their tune and tried to post the event, recalibrate what they had actually said and try and make it out to be something different. And I think those sorts of instances acted as signals and symbols to us about the dangers of speaking out. And of course the electoral system and the party list system plays an incredibly important part in that. And then I suppose when I did take the stand I took on the arms deal and I was first kicked off the Public Accounts Committee and then compelled to resign from Parliament, people started talking in the ANC caucus nationally about being Feinstein, which meant this is the consequence of speaking out and taking a line that was different from the leadership line. So it manifested itself in all sorts of ways, and because people's livelihoods and their political careers were at stake, they were very quick to change their tune. And I suppose some of it comes from the nature of the ANC, which has historically been a broad church organization, and has in many respects, as you have said on a number of occasions, Mark, almost represents a family in some ways. In other ways, a church, rather than a political organization. I wonder if you have any comments on that, the nature of the ANC, and in the context of that, how Thabo Mbeki has responded to what was, in effect, a rejection by the family at Polokwane, and what you feel almost is, because, and I am a distant observer, I see almost a disengagement from the political processes, from government.
I'm really glad you raised this thing of the family, and you call yourself a distant observer, but I'm interested also to hear from you, if the ANC is a family,
what are you in the family? Are you the sort of troublesome younger son who sort of points out the problems that no one else will acknowledge? There is something, I feel it's absolutely critical to understand the AFC, even now, even post-Polokwane, as an organism very different to the Labour Party in Britain or the Democratic Party in the United States, because there's this kind of perpetual internal struggle between, on the one hand, being progressive, being a vanguard, being the sort of a beacon of democracy on this continent, but on the other hand, being this family. And I think if one really wants to understand what happened between Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma, one needs to understand that they are brothers. They remain brothers. So even when there's that letter that was written to City Press, I don't know how many of you saw it, or saw reference to it last week, in which it was signed by Jacob Zuma and Thabo Mbeki saying, there's no problem among us, everything's fine. I mean, sure, that's a strategy, it's a shtick, but it's also members of a family trying to deal with the fact that they've fallen out. And because you're all members of families, you'll know this, that when members of families fall out, it's pretty bloody. You know this from reading Shakespeare, from the Greek tragedies. And speaking about Shakespeare and the Greek tragedies, I think what I'm watching now, as I look at, I mean, I mentioned in response to Jeremy's question that my work was not over, and that I have to carry on following Thabo Mbeki and documenting what's happening. And what I've seen since my book came out, since Polokwane, is in a way, the kind of the tragic fifth act of a Shakespearean tragedy, where a brilliant but very human character is brought down by his own, I would say, fatal flaws. And I keep on thinking, as I think of which tragedy, I keep on thinking of Coriolanus, which happens to be one of Thabo Mbeki's favorite plays. And I refer to Coriolanus a lot in my book. In fact, in a book I'm bringing out with Jonathan Ball in March next year, a collection of essays called The Second Transition. One of the essays is Mbeki as Coriolanus. And I won't talk too much about Coriolanus now, except to say that his one of his fatal flaws was that he refused to be anything other than himself. One of his lines was, I play the man I am. A sort of profound anti-spin line. But another thing that Coriolanus said is when he was banished from Rome for refusing to be what the mob, the hooligans in the streets, wanted him to be, he was banished, and he turned round to the people of Rome and he said, I banish you. There is a world elsewhere. And with that, he flounced off to join the enemy and plan the sacking of Rome. Now, I often, when I look at Thabo Mbeki in the last few months, I often feel like he's saying to us, I banish you. You rejected me, so I'm rejecting you back. I'm off to Japan. I'm off to Tanzania. Damn you, there is a world elsewhere. And you can remain here with your uncertainty. That's part of the line that is where Coriolanus says, I banish you, there is a world elsewhere, and you can remain here with your uncertainty. And he's left us remaining here with our uncertainty. And yes, Andrew, I think that a lot of that has to do with a feeling, and I don't know this, by the way, it's not like I'm sitting with Mbeki Ozbek and Village every night talking about his pain. I don't have that sort of relationship with him, and I'm also not his therapist. He doesn't come and lie on my couch and tell me what's wrong. So I'm imagining what he's seeing based on the evidence. And yes, I think that what's happening is a feeling of profound rejection from the family. And to the extent that I maintain my empathy with the baby, because as his biographer, I have to maintain empathy with professional precondition. Just as a therapist does need to remain empathy with their most murderous patients. And I don't believe in Mbeki's murderous, by the way. But to the extent that I do have empathy with him, it must be a terrible rejection. Because, I mean, love him or loathe him, Mbeki has given his life to this movement. And the movement says, damn you, we don't want you anymore. Now the movement said, Daniel, we don't want you anymore, because there was a belief that he was not being responsive enough to the people who had elected him, like Coriolanus. I mean, what Embeki's done, Embeki's speech, his stump at Coriolanus was quite extraordinary. I don't know how many of you remember it, but he basically called the people who needed to vote for him a mob, a bunch of hooligans who were parvenus in the ANC and who didn't understand the traditions of the movement. Of course they weren't going to vote for him. And I think there's something quite tragic about that. And the tragedy I link to something that a word that Mbeki himself gave me, which is the word disconnect. I think Mbeki has been, since he was a young man, despite his intellectual brilliance and despite his ability to be a political operative very effectively, he has found it very hard to connect with the people he represents since he has been an elected official. And I think we're all suffering from that disconnection. We're seeing the evidence of that disconnection at the moment. It was interesting. I don't know how many of you looked at his budget speech and his response to it in the last few days. And for me, it was the best and the worst of them. It was thoughtful. It was careful. It acknowledged problems, but it didn't acknowledge any kind of emotional territory. And that's what Mbeki's never been able to do. So there's this fascinating line where he repeats a quote that Buthelezi said, which is a quote from Seneca, to err is human, right? And he said, his response was, I act, therefore I err. People who act err by definition. He's correct. But he never said, I'm sorry for having erred where I err. And I think that's been his huge fault, an inability to say I'm sorry. So, once more, with this terrible xenophobia that we've all been experiencing, he was very strong, and I love how strong he was in saying, we will not tolerate this. We will not tolerate this way of behaving to other people. This is not what we call for liberation. Brilliant that he said that, but he was not able to say, hey, how is it that we have all as South Africans been complicit in allowing the situation to come to bear? He was not able to say, I'm feeling a terrible pain and I know you are too. It's that inability to connect that I think is daunting.
I think you're right. And as you were talking there, I mean, what came into my mind is the experience of living in the United Kingdom at the moment and observing such a similar thing happening with Gordon Brown.
Yeah.
Someone who has given his life to the Labour movement in this case, and of course there are significant differences, as you point out, with the ANC, and who has now got to where he has always wanted to be, and is almost genetically unable to connect emotionally with the needs of the people he leads. And he feels distant, remote, and incompetent, frankly. And he's a brilliant, brilliant man. It's quite extraordinary. So do you want to
comment? I just want to say about the family.
I mean, I suppose one of the things I'm interested in is why we need our leaders to connect. And in a way I do, or why we need our leaders to be emotional. And I suppose I do have some empathy for Mbeki here, particularly post Mandela, which is that on the one hand, you know, we're saying we want somebody to take over and be sort of rational and sensible rather than just emotional, and we want a modern democracy, and then Mbeki comes in and we suddenly all want a father to love us again. And I think we do put incredible pressure on our leaders. And in a way, we put such pressure on them, no wonder they fuck up.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is, I think, we want competence. We do want rationality. We do want logic. But we don't want those things in the absence of understanding what we are feeling. And I think that has been both of their failing. You know, when the arms deal trauma is going on, when the xenophobic violence is going on, it's just show that you understand what people are feeling. And I think they've both been dismal failures at their ability to do that. And interestingly, I don't think it's too much to expect of our politicians. Yes, of course, we create, you know, these mythical straw men most of the time. And then we knock them down. And, you know, I'm just wondering whether Barack Obama is the next myth we're creating, only to knock down at some point in the future. I hope not, but political history tells us something different. I want to come back for a moment, and I'm conscious of time, Jeremy, to this issue of family, and partly in answering where I fit in, but also to say that I think the most extraordinary thing about Polokwane, that Thabo standing there and, you know, describing the people he leads as this mob, is the tragedy of his role in creating the mob. And part of that is, I suppose, how I see the family now. And I see the family as being driven by divisions. And like in all families, those divisions are quite complex, and they involve issues of personality and psychology. But they also, crucially, as so many of us know in our own family, involve the issue of who gets the spoil. And I think, importantly, in this family, that has become a very important issue. And it's again somewhere where I think Thabo has failed to connect with the perception of the family he is leading as being people who are enriching themselves, and part of that family saying, no, hang on, now it's time that we got the spoil and your time has passed. And then there's another component of the family, because like all families, this is a nuanced and complex family, who are saying, but hold on, in this family, the issue shouldn't be about who's getting the spoils. The issue should be about how we can be the best family we can possibly be. And so where I find myself in it is, I do feel an outsider. I feel an outsider not only because of where I live, but because of the decisions I took. But at the same time, I feel that there are certain people in the family who are trying to connect with me to say, you're not an outsider. And I suppose it's some of those people who are not too closely linked either to Mbeki or Zuma who are trying to argue that this family isn't about which of us gets the spoils, but it's about everybody else. And I think that is so crucial. But just to take, and perhaps the final question, Jeremy, depending on the timing, to take the family analogy, but I'd just like to ask you, you know, you spoke about this empathy that a biographer obviously has to feel for his or her subject to be able to do the sort of extraordinary work that you've done. How did you engage with those sort of multiple levels of your relationship with Thabo Mbeki, many of which are sort of at a psychic level almost, because as you say, you're not the therapist and you're not there at night over the whiskey. What happened to you post-Polokwane in terms of your relationship with Thabo Mbeki, given what has happened to him?
It's a very difficult question, but I think one worth trying to interrogate. The first thing to say is, well, let me begin in a tangent. I mean, you spoke about how you were accused of being part of Take Us to Kwame campaign. Just after my book came out, and just before Polokwane, I was accosted by somebody on the street who said, great book, but it's not going to help your man. To which my answer was and is, he's not my man.
Yeah.
You know, this, I'm often asked about whether I like Thabo Mbeki, and if I did like him, do I dislike him now? And do I feel betrayed by him? And am I hurt by him? And my answer is that from 20 years of being a journalist who writes political profiles and works as a biographical journalist, even though I'm not a therapist and I'm not a mental health professional, I feel like there's an approach I have to my subject. Even if I spend 8 years working on them rather than just a week working on them, which is what I was doing when I did my Mail and Guardian profile,
yeah,
is that there is a kind of, there's a way that you establish, for want of a better word, I would call professional empathy. And you know, I do feel that. I mean, I don't hang out with these people. I don't drink with them. I don't socialize with them. I don't sleep with them. I write about them. And I reserve strong emotions of love and hate for the people in my personal life. And I feel like that, I've had to keep on doing that to keep my sanity. That being said, for the last 8 years, I've had a photograph of Thabo Mbeki on his wedding day with his beautiful bride and this sort of lovely, open, handsome smile looking down at me as I sit at my computer. And there was a feeling of liberation when the book came out. The book came out at the same time as we moved. And there was this wonderful feeling of liberation taking that poster down and deciding not to put it back up again in my new home. And then a feeling of despair once I realized that even if that you know, he's still there, even if he's not there as the poster, I'm still involved with him because I have to carry on writing about him, and his story's not over. And you know, I live in this world, and I'm not immune to the anger that so many people are feeling about Thabo Mbeki. And I would be lying if I said I didn't feel a lot of that anger myself. I mean, as a biographer, I can't write about it, but perhaps as a political commentator, I can and will. I mean, my anger at his deciding to stand for the phony was profound. I thought it's just in terms of his own legacy, because I believe there's a lot in Mbeki's legacy that is worth celebrating, and we can talk about that if you want to. I think the way he destroyed his own legacy by deciding to stand against Jacob Zuma for the phony and therefore preventing the space for another viable candidate to stand, I think it made me very, very cross. It made me very, very cross that he lied in the celeb Epiphany instance. But despite that anger, I think that one of the things I'm trying to do, that anger that I feel myself, is that I am conscious as a Mbeki's biographer how we as a society are creating Thabo Mbeki as some sort of lightning rod for all our anger and frustration and feelings of betrayal. And I quite frankly think that's very unhealthy. Some journalists, I think, have written brilliantly about this already. Adam Habib wrote about it in the Business Day the day before yesterday. And if you haven't seen his piece, I strongly urge you to go and get it. Brendan Boyle wrote about it brilliantly in the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago. It's very easy to blame Mbeki for all our ills. I got an email during the height of the xenophobia inviting people to come and listen to Ken Dibeti of the NDC, who's currently, I think, still in detention. And this happened at the height of the xenophobia that he was speaking at Bridgestone Hall. And the invitation said that the xenophobia was the first ghastly manifestation of Thabo Mbeki's policy of prior diplomacy. No. It might have been exacerbated by Thabo Mbeki's policy of prior diplomacy, but Thabo Mbeki is not responsible for what's happening in Zimbabwe. And he was also not responsible individually for what happened in Riga Park in Ramaphosa Swaziland. He's responsible as part of the collective, and he certainly has exacerbated the situation by his sometimes quite inexplicable behavior. Certainly his embrace of Mugabe at a time he's going to be an impartial mediator. But I'm interested in why it is that we need to put him down. And I think we need to put him down because we set him up. I think what's happening at the moment, I think we're living through a time of regicide, killing of the king. And I think we need to say off with his head because we made him a king in the first place. We deferred so much to him. You know, he was the philosopher king who had all the answers, who was going to save us. And hopefully we've learned our lesson as a polity. And hopefully that's the best possible thing that's come out of Paul of Friday, is an understanding that there is no Godhead, that all leaders are flawed and possibly even corrupt. So that's what I'm feeling at the moment.
Thank you. I'd like to see if there are any questions from the floor. I'm going to take three, and I think you will need a mic, so I'm just going to help you.
Hello. My question is for Mark, and I want to just challenge two aspects of his account from Berkeley. The first is your accountability as a tragic figure. I seem to detect in that a certain resistance towards apportioning responsibility and blame for the quite egregious mistakes that have been made. I would go further than calling them mistakes. So I'd like to just get your reflection on whether your professional empathy is not going too far in your moral sense. And the second one is the description of Mbeki as brilliant. You use the word quite often, and just as a counterweight, if one listens to Mbeki speak, he says not speak straight. What would you put that down to? Because for me, it reflects a muddled mind. Would you say we should look for psychological explanations and not for intellectual explanations? Thank you.
Other question?
This is a question to
Andy. Could we just get people's names?
My name is David Dyson. My question to Andy is, could you gaze into the future a bit and suggest how the ANC will deal with Thabo Mbeki's obvious complicity in the conflict?
Should we take that?
Yeah.
Edward, I mean, I don't, you know, there's no question that a biographer judges. And any biographer who says he doesn't judge is being disingenuous. There's judgment in what you choose to put into your book, what you leave out, who you choose to quote, how you choose to quote them. Of course biographers judge, but the role of a biographer is not to judge, it's to make sense of a life. To make sense of a life within the context of a time, and within the context of times, and to understand why somebody has acted the way he has now, or she has. One of the reactions to my book that I like the most is a reaction from Justice Malala, who, as you all know if you read the Times, is one of the strongest and most righteous Mbeki critics that there is. And Malala read my book and he said, I've just read Mark Davis's book. Great read, and he wrote this just before the final. And this tells me why Mbeki should not remain the ANC president. Davis's book tells me why Mbeki should not remain the ANC president. Now, that was Malala's prerogative to judge in that way in an opinion column. And I may well and probably will make similar judgments when I'm writing op-ed pieces. I think that I would not have been able to do my work if I'd rendered that judgment, if that judgment had been overwhelming, overriding, writing my biography. I also don't think you would have been able to read it. I think it would have been terribly boring if I had sort of put the knife in chapter after chapter where I thought the knife needed to go in. What I think my job is to do is to sit on the shoulder of my subject and see the world the way my subject sees it, and thereby enabling critics and commentators and analysts to make the judgments that they need to. And the last thing I'll say on that is that one of the most powerful biographies I've ever read is Gita Sereny's biography of Albert Speer, Nazism's architect, one of the architects of the Final Solution. And Sereny was very empathetic to Speer. And she took the judgment as a given, perhaps, in a way that's easier with Mbeki. Because Speer was obviously murderous. Whereas Mbeki, I mean, you might say what he's done is egregious, that the jury might still be out for others. But nonetheless, I mean, I got an insight into Nazi Germany from Sereny's empathetic work that was profoundly different, substantively, to what I would get from a polemical dissection or attack on Nazism. And so, no, I don't believe, I personally don't believe I'm being morally ambivalent. I think it's my job. My job requires me to work in a certain way. And I understand that in this current context, that is perhaps very flammable, because there's things are very raw at the moment, and people are very angry. And I guess I just have to take that if I'm going to carry on doing my job properly. I think that one of Mbeki's tragic flaws is the way he allows his brilliance to be muddled. And my book outlines why I think he allows his brilliance to be muddled. But I think he is brilliant. And I hope my book explains why I think he's brilliant.
Thanks. I mean, I agree with Mark, and I suppose that I probably am relieved that I'm not a biographer. And I think another great example, a recent example of this moral ambiguity, is in, I think, Philip French's biography of Mapo, which generates a lot of the same sort of debate and moral complexity. And I regard myself, I suppose, as more of a polemicist. I mean, I never describe myself as an author or a writer, but occasionally as a writer and a campaigner. The next book I'm doing is on the global arms trade and how it undermines accountable democracy. And in many ways, that's a lot easier than what Mark does, which brings me to the specific question I've been asked around Thabo Mbeki's complicity and how the ANC will view it. First of all, one has to ask the question, is he complicit? And my answer clearly in my book and in the statements I've made subsequently, I would suggest yes. Both as chairperson of the minister's subcommittee that made all of the decisions that undermined the procurement process quite fundamentally, so landing up with a jet from BAE in the United Kingdom that the Air Force said they would only accept if the politicians forced them to buy it, and that was 2.5 times the cost of the jet that they actually wanted to buy and that met their technical need, which the BAE jet, by their own admission, never had. Secondly, I think that he was complicit in the cover-up from destroying the Public Accounts Committee as a non-partisan body at the apex of the accountability process, to engaging, I believe, unconstitutionally with the investigators after excluding Judge Heath, and telling them exactly who and what they could and could not investigate in relation to the arms deal. And then I also believe that he was either directly involved in soliciting money for the ANC or condoned the solicitation of money for the ANC from the successful bidders, which in effect amounts to saying, if you give us money, we will give you these multi-billion-dollar contracts. So using one's state office to procure reward for your political party. Now, I also argued in the book that I didn't think that Mbeki, or I certainly have seen no evidence that Mbeki had personally benefited from the arms deal, and I made the statement that I just didn't think that that is what motivated him or interested him. And obviously, subsequent to the book coming out subsequent to Polokwane, there have been claims, including in the ANC's National Executive Committee, that possibly he did. And this is one of the big unanswered questions that needs to be further explored and investigated. Now, how will the ANC respond? I mean, my guess would be that if there is an orderly transition to a Jacob Zuma government, and part of that orderly transition, I assume, would be some sort of addressing of Zuma's legal problems, as we discussed earlier, then my instinct is the ANC are going to lose interest in Thabo Mbeki's complicity in the arms deal. However, if what Polokwane was an apocryphal moment in terms of a new regime of accountability within the ANC and government, then we will see that complicity investigated further, I would hope, along with a number of other people against whom there is substantial evidence of wrongdoing in the arms deal. But at this point, to be quite frank, I wouldn't hold my breath.
We have very little time left. I can take another one question. No more questions.
Hi, my name is Sarah. This is mainly a question to Mark. You both speak about the ANC as a family, which is a helpful analogy in But my question is, what about the other members of the family? We're concentrating very much on human and baby at the moment, but I keep hoping for a little bit of insight from the media, it's not necessarily their fault, but to understand where those other narratives are. What are the other stories we'll start seeing in the future, apart from the baby, you know, or are all of their narratives tied to these two fathers?
I'll answer that very quickly and then hand over to Andrew. Firstly, I write in my book, just to come back to the previous question about the arms deal, that if the arms deal is the poisoned well of South African politics, then it is Thabo Mbeki who poisoned the water. And that's in my book. So as to my question about judgment, you know, one does judge. It's not clear yet why he poisoned the water and whether it's for reasons of corruption or whether he was just misguided. Your question about the family, I think, is a great one. And I think, in a way, what happened at Polokwane, and I was at Polokwane, so I'm absolutely convinced it happened, was a reassertion of the narratives of other people in the family. It was a time where the branches, the membership, bit back, they fought back. And I'm absolutely convinced, from having spoken to probably 1,000 delegates, that most of the people who voted for Jacob Zuma were voting for their own right to say what happens in the ANC. They were not voting for Jacob Zuma. They were voting for what they believed would be a new regime within the ANC, where they would be heard and where the leadership would be accountable to them. Now, whether they were stooges, whether they become voting cattle, whether their stories become dominant, whether South Africa becomes a participatory, accountable democracy now, because, you know, this was the sign of the Zuma camp, I mean of the Mbeki camp in Polokwane, 3 terms. And one of the responses of the Zuma camp was this, 2 terms. And it's very significant because it was 2 terms for Mbeki, ergo 2 terms for Zuma. So I think the jury is out as to whether that notion will become dominant in the ANC, or whether it is just a changing of the palace guard. It's incumbent upon all of us to make sure, whether we're members of the ANC or not, that as voters, as South Africans, our stories are dominant rather than the stories of our politicians. Whether we have the power as a man to do that is really, I think, up to us.
I think I would just add to that what I said earlier about a part of the family saying, but why are we arguing about the soil? That's not what this family should be interested in. And I do think that even amongst the leadership, I think Mark is both part of what was the bottom-up effect at Polokwane, but also the leadership level, I think, and permeate both. There are those who align themselves very strongly with Thabo, there are those who align themselves very strongly with Jacob Zuma. But I think at a leadership level and also at a branch level, there are what Adam Habib calls the independents or the third wayers, those who believe that what would be best for the organisation and for the country would be to move beyond the Mbeki moment and the Zuma moment, and to in effect recapture the ANC for the values and ethos that it has held historically. Now, part of what is unfolding is the extent to which those close to Zuma are going to predominate, or whether there is going to be the space for somebody who is more of this independent grouping to actually assume power. And that will play its way out in people within the ANC saying and then hopefully discussing whether it is appropriate to have as your candidate for the president of the country somebody who is facing charges of corruption and fraud, and whether there is space for the organization as a whole to say, well, no, it's not, somebody else needs to move in, or whether in fact Zuma's power base is strong enough for them to say he was democratically elected and therefore we're going to go forward with that. He has no case to answer for, purely politically inspired. And that, I think, is the battle that's going to play itself out over the next few months in the lead up to the election.
I'm going to bring this thing to an end now. Just in conclusion, before we thank Mark and Andrew, I'd like to say that they both will be signing copies of their books at the Jonathan Ball stand, which is just out there around the corner, queues on the left and the right for the book. I also just want to mention, because Andrew was perhaps too modest to mention, that he starts work on a new book, and not content with just irritating the arms dealers around the South African arms deal, he's going to write a book on the international arms dealing. That's for publication sometime in the future, I guess, Andrew.
In the next 12 to 18 months.
12 to 18 months. And of course, Mark has mentioned he is writing a book for Jonathan Ball on the second transition. Thank you very much for attending, and please could you just put your hands together for Mark.